Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday morning, March 11th, 2026 meeting of the Minnesota House Commerce and Finance Policy Committee. We'll call the meeting to order. There is a quorum present. Our first order of business is the approval of the minutes from yesterday's meeting. And Representative Allen, have you had a chance to review the minutes from Tuesday, March 10th? And if so, would you be willing to move them this morning?
Mr. Chair, as Representative Allen was looking, I reviewed the minutes. I would move the minutes.
In place of Representative Allen, Representative Heintzman moves the minutes from March 10th. Representative Allen, any corrections to the minutes that you could see? You still are a freshman. I have to give you a little bit of a bad time. So.
None that I can see, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other corrections? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails. Our first order of business today is to bring back a bill that we had in front of the committee in the not-so-distant past, and it is the travel insurance policy. And this is a bill that is co-authored by Representative Perryman and Representative Elkin. Representative Perryman, if you'll make your way to the testifiers table. Just to remind you, this is a bill on travel insurance. We did have some questions as to whether there was a fiscal note, and we're going to have Representative Perryman update us on that, as well as an amendment she has that will make this bill consistent with the version that the Senate has. Good morning and welcome. Representative Perryman, I will move House File 3766 before the committee to be re-referred to the General Register. Co-Chair Perryman.
Thank you and good morning,
Chair. Co-Vice Chair Perryman.
Thank you and good morning, Chairs, Co-Chairs, and all members. Yes, I am back again with an Amendment A1, which is basically removing the tax on this amendment really deletes the section of the bill relating to insurance premium taxes you'll find on page 9. This language has been deemed, after going to the Senate and moving through over there, unnecessary as an insurance taxation, which is already addressed in Chapter 379 of the tax code. So it is not necessary to include the similar tax language in the insurance code. That is a simple amendment, and that's what I have for today.
Members, questions on the Perryman A1 amendment to House File 3766? Seeing none. Oh, no, we're good. I thought you were. Got to watch those hand motions. It's like an auction. Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wishes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Perryman, to your bill as amended.
It's a great bill. We've heard it already. I'm not going to give you much more download there. But one thing, Chair, if I may cover about last time we laid it over was there was consideration of a fiscal note. We have followed up with the Department of Commerce, and they have deemed and have agreed that there is no fiscal note to this bill. So we are clear to land and continue on the path to the General Registry.
Very good. Members, questions? We did take public testimony on this, so we are going to dispense with that on the bill. We did that at the previous meeting. Members, any questions for Representative Perryman or co-author Elkins on this? Representative Elkins, do you want to share any comments before we take action?
I think everything that needs to be said has been said.
Very good. All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File. Well, Representative Perryman, any wrap-ups? There seems to be no member questions.
No, just feel free to travel and know you're insured.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3766, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and you are on your way. Our next order of business is going to be another bill from one of our members who is not here yet. However, the co-author of that bill, Representative Reimer, will be presenting. And this bill is chief authored by another one of our members, Representative Hewitt. And so with that, as Representative Reimer is making his way to the testifying table.
Are we up right
You're
now?
Up.
You're up.
Wow.
Maybe.
Representative Hewitt, welcome.
Welcome, 007.
Catch your breath.
Yeah, no kidding.
You're good. You're good. Catch your breath.
The youth in government. Oh, that's cold. I'll have to go off my phone here for my notes. Good morning, committee.
Oh, I haven't moved the bill yet. So I'm going to move House File 3972 before the committee, and there is also an author's amendment on this, if I'm not mistaken, Representative Hewitt. Am I correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is an amendment. It gets the bill in the shape we want it to. It's a compromise between the department and the stakeholders.
Very good. I will move the A1 amendment for Representative Hewitt to get the bill in the form that he would like. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to House File 3972 to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Go ahead, Representatives Hewitt and Reimer, on the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing the bill today. This is an interesting bill. It came to me not too long ago, but it involves the Airbnb industry, or there's other, basically they're called online market homes, I guess. But what this basically covers is, there's been some confusion, I guess, if a tenant rents it, or a customer rents it, they always thought they had an insurance that they called it an insurance, but it wasn't really an insurance. It was a guarantee that if something got damaged during the rental and they could not retrieve it back from the customer, they would be able to act on insurance. But it's not insurance; it's a guarantee. They make sure that if the customer doesn't pay them, that if the renter doesn't pay the client, the homeowner back directly, they will support it and basically pay the homeowner, make them whole. And I believe Representative Reimer, you have some stuff to say.
Representative Reimer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, for spearheading this bill. I got approached about this too. Guarantees are quite common. You know, you'll have guarantees with contractors and subcontractors. You can often guarantee, you know, for your child as they're building credit, guarantee on rent, things of that nature. What this does is it cleans up language. It's got support from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and then the Minnesota Federation of Insurance. And, it's a clarification bill. Other states do this. In your packet, you'll find a couple of stories of people who have been impacted by this. And it's an easy way to make sure that your property stays clean and effective as you're renting out your home. So good bill. Happy to be the co-author on it.
Thank you. And is there a possible oral amendment here as well?
Looking to do a voice amendment that takes the days from 120 down to 90 days.
So, Representative Reimer, if I am not mistaken, and members, if you want to grab the bill 3972, I believe the oral amendment that Representative Reimer is referring to is going to be found on page 3, line number 28, where it changes it from 180 days to 120.
From 120 down to 90.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, so it's an amendment to the amendment.
We
should have done the amendment to the amendment on that. So, folks, if you direct your attention to the A1 amendment, where we moved it from 180 to 120 days, that's now going to be Representative Reimer a 90
days.
So Representative Reimer would move that the language that is found on the A1 amendment, even though it's been adopted, that language, that to be moved and struck from 120 days down to 90 days. Discussions on the oral amendment to get the bill in the final shape that the authors would like, hopefully. Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Ms. Pompom.
Chair and members, just for the record, the A1 amendment will be amended page 1, line 7. Delete 120 and insert 90.
I was hoping that someone would give me the exact procedure on that because I wasn't sure. Testing the chairs this morning. So with that, we now have the bill in the form that the authors would like. And it looks like maybe we have a testifier here this morning as well.
Mr. Chair, I do have Mr. Brad Nail, who is a represents the association. So if we could turn to him, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nail, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brad Nail. I'm here on behalf of Airbnb.
I would thank you to Representative Hewitt and Reimer for taking the lead on this bill. Just a couple of quick points to add to what they've said. Firstly, we participated in the NCOIL model development process for this bill. We're proud that the model received bipartisan support there and that it has received bipartisan support here. Also at NCOIL, as well as here, we have solicited the input of the insurance industry and regulators and incorporated their edits whenever possible, as you see through the amendment process that we just went through here this morning. In doing so, we believe we have a good final product for your consideration. And secondly, these guarantees are important for our hosts, the property owners who agree to rent their properties out. Under the rental contract, if a guest or a renter causes damage to the host's property, the guest must pay those damages, and most of the time that's what happens. Sometimes, however, the renter does not live up to their obligations, and it's important for the host to have peace of mind that in those situations, in our case it would be Airbnb, can step in, compensate them for their damages under the guarantee, and then Airbnb can elect to continue pursuing the renter who caused the damages. But the host is not required to chase down the renter or make a claim under their homeowner's policy in order to be made whole. We think that's just good business. So the Minnesota statutes are currently silent on guarantees specifically for rental properties like the one that we offer, and this bill fills that void while also codifying sound consumer protection. So we support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nail. Before I go to public testimony, I'm just going to officially make sure that we have the bill properly in front of us. So I'm going to make sure that we know that we are working on House File 3972 as amended, and its recommendation is to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, just to make sure that we have all of our procedural things taken care of here correctly this morning. And with that, I do not have any other testifiers who have signed up in advance to testify on the bill, but we'll ask if there's anyone present who would like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 3972, dealing with insurance on Airbnb as amended in front of the committee. Seeing no public testimony, members, questions. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a note of thanks for Representative Hewitt and Reimer bringing this bill forward. I have had damage in my short-term rental property. This is a problem. Your bill addresses it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Heinzman. Anyone else? Any other member questions, comments? If not, we're going to toss it to the authors, Representative Hewitt.
And Mr. Chair, and I'll let Representative White, I did want to ask a question. Is there a clarification why this is going to Ways and not to the floor? Is there a possibility of a fiscal note on it? Or?
I can give you two answers. The one that's the most convenient answer right now is that's what my paper tells me. I thought it would be funnier than it was, but apparently not. So, that's what the chair's instructions said. But I think it has to go to Ways and Means because there is some small fiscal matter that's related to it that Ways and Means would need to see and just kind of pass through on it. I don't know for sure what it is, but we were advised yesterday that that's the destination on it.
Okay. With what the chair would like, I would accept. So saying that, thank you for everyone here in the bill today. I think it's a good bill, and hopefully we can get through this fast. Representative Reimer.
Well, thank you, Representative Hewitt and members of the committee. Yeah, nothing more to add. Let's get this through. Thanks.
All right. Seeing no other questions, thank you to the authors for your work on this. And with that, we will move to renew my motion to re-refer House File 3972 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you again for your time, gentlemen. Yeah. Before we get on to other bills, we're going to have a presentation, and we'll probably take, maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of about 45 minutes or so, to have folks from the council the Health Council of Nonprofits come forward and talk to us a little bit about how health insurance is structured in the state of Minnesota, provide us some additional information maybe on what's happening in the individual market as they represent the large number of carriers who are in the nonprofit arena here in the state of Minnesota. And so with that, we have before you at the testifying table, Chelsea Olson and Dan Andreessen. And with that, I believe that there's some information in your packets as well as a PowerPoint to follow along with on the discussion and presentation today as well. Ms. Olson, are you going to be the first one to present today? All right. With that, let's go ahead and introduce you, have you state your name for the record, and proceed with your presentation this morning. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Good morning. My name is Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans.
Ms. Olson, if you could just come a little closer, I'll pull the microphone toward you, that would help.
Better.
Thank you. Much better.
Perfect. Good morning. Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Today we're going to talk to you about the individual market in Minnesota. We can go to the next slide. So this is a relatively small portion of the whole market in Minnesota. It's that green slice on the pie chart, and it's also marked here for those who have a black and white copy, individual market. It's about 3% of the overall market in Minnesota, but it includes people in each of your districts. So Minnesotans get their health insurance from three basic big buckets. The first is coverage from an employer. This includes self-insured plans that you'll often see with large companies like your Target or 3M. There's small and large group plans, and then CGIP, which covers all of you and other state employees. The next category is state and federal government programs. These include Medicare, Medicaid, MinnesotaCare, and TRICARE. And then the last category is what we're talking about today, the individual market. So these are folks who don't get their health insurance from an employer, but are entrepreneurs, daycare providers, farmers, small business owners, et cetera. So this slide shows you the health insurance carriers in the individual market. It's served exclusively by nonprofit health insurers, and that's not because for-profits aren't allowed to serve this market, it's because they choose not to serve this market. So we have Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Minnesota, Health Partners, Medica, and Courts currently. You'll note that UCARE is no longer a part of this market and has been, their membership has been absorbed by the other plans in the market. As nonprofit health insurers, we don't have shareholders who receive dividends. There's no profit margins included in premium rates, and member health plans invest very heavily in their communities. This next slide shows you enrollment in the individual market. You'll note back in 2014, it was about 300,000 Minnesotans, and then you'll notice a drastic drop in both 2016 and 2017. And that's a large result of when the ACA was passed, there was a federal reinsurance program that was eventually phased out. So in 2016 and 2017, there was less federal subsidy in the market, which meant that costs and premiums skyrocketed. The market was incredibly unstable. Premiums were increasing over 50%. Carriers were dropping out of the market, and the individual market was on the brink of collapse. You'll notice how it the drop-off kind of levels out in the 2017-2018 area. There was an emergency.
Ms. Olson, I do hate to interrupt your testimony.
Yes.
We are getting advised by the tech folks that we're still not able to pick your voice up. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to have you flip to the other side of where Mr. Andreessen is sitting and grab that mic, if you don't mind. Well, that works, too.
Never had a problem hearing from you before.
Louder.
Sorry for the interruption. Thank you. Proceed.
No, that's fine. Is this better?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, perfect. I'll try not to shout at you. So in 2017, there was an emergency premium subsidy program passed by the legislature to help kind of the emergency stabilization of the market. And then in 2018, the reinsurance program was put into effect. And you'll see that enrollment really steadies out with the continuation of the reinsurance program and begins to climb. You will see on the next page here. Are you still doing that? All right, these are the 2026 individual market rates. So there are changes ranging from an average of 7.4% increase to 30.76% increase. And these higher premiums are attributable to state mandate changes, higher healthcare acuity and usage, inflation, and then primarily the expiration of federal enhanced premium tax credits. So it's essential to note that these increases we see in 2026 would be 47% higher without our reinsurance program. We would have returned to a similar market as back in 2017. You can look on this next slide here. It just shows you these trends again in individual market premiums. You see that big dip, or individual market rates, you see that big dip in 2018, and then again, you see the slight uptick happening in 2026. So health plan products are highly regulated, and they must be approved by Commerce before they are offered on the individual market. Insurance products are created a year in advance, and they're designed by actuaries who evaluate healthcare cost trends, state and federal regulations, and utilize data and statistics to estimate the financial uncertainty and calculate the cost of health insurance premiums and cost sharing based on expected healthcare costs. So they can only rate enrollees on age, smoking status, and geographic location. Plans submit their initial rates to Commerce in early June, and Commerce then publishes those proposed rates. Commerce then reviews the proposed products and rates to ensure that they're actuarially justified and that policies comply with all relevant laws and regulations. And then by October 1st of each year, Commerce releases the final rates for the coming year, and open enrollment begins in November. And then Commerce will continue to regulate normal business operations of the health insurers. Like I said before, rates are based on expected medical costs, including the cost of paying providers, hospital, pharmacists, and pharmaceutical drugs. Plans also must take into account the cost of covering all mandated benefits, the 10 required under the ACA, plus the 71 additional state mandates added by the legislature. Plans also create networks and formularies to manage healthcare safety, quality, and costs. And then all of these costs are split between premiums and cost sharing, and the ratio of each depends on which metal level is purchased. So the ACA mandated that plan premiums and cost sharing must fall into four different metal levels for the individual market. And the coverage of benefits is largely the same between these plans. The difference is whether you'll be spending more upfront each month on your monthly premiums or in cost sharing when you receive a service. So the bronze plans are mandated to balance 60% of costs and premiums and 40% in cost sharing. Under these plans, you'll pay the lowest in monthly premiums, but the most out-of-pocket in cost sharing when you receive service. For ones like the gold or platinum, you'll spend much more in your monthly premiums, but when you receive care, you'll spend much less out-of-pocket. And the platinum plans were so expensive in terms of premiums that not really anyone purchased them, and so they're not offered on the individual market currently. And then this slide shows you the number of carriers by county. There are at least two carriers in each county, so people have choices of plans and carriers. In many counties, you have the option to choose between all four health plans in the market. It was important to note that this is also a result of the reinsurance program. Back in 2016-2017, you saw plans dropping out of the market and plans instituting enrollment caps to be able to balance costs and the instability, which meant that in some counties, people only had the option of one plan. So now, due in large part to the stability brought by reinsurance, everyone has at least two plans to choose from.
Mr. Chair, Dan Andreessen with the Council Health Plan. So as also mentioned, there's availability throughout the state, but it does vary depending on where you live. Some counties have multiple options and some have very few. And part of that is due in part due to the cost of care within those areas of the state. It's just difficult to do business in some of those places. You can look at these two charts are graphics to kind of illustrate that a little bit more. The one on the right is from Minnesota Community Measurement, which looks at healthcare costs across the zip code areas. And as you can see, costs are significantly higher in the south and northern regions of the state. That is primarily in part because of the mix of providers that you have in those areas. It's mainly dominated by, you know, large hospital systems, Ascension to the north and Mayo to the south. Whereas you look in the metro area, there are multiple hospitals, multiple providers, and so that just more competition brings down costs. The graphic to the right is a per county average monthly premiums for a 40-year-old Minnesotan who's buying the second lowest silver plan on Minsure. This chart is from Commerce. And I've overlaid the geographic rating areas onto that map. So as Ms. Olson mentioned, we can rate on geographic rating area, and this is a requirement under the ACA that all states have to create geographic rating areas. There's not really a lot of guidance from the feds on how you do it. All states do it a little bit differently. Florida has 67 areas. There are some states that have just one. That is in part due to size, you know, like Hawaii has one geographic rating area, but New Jersey has one as well. There is language in statute that does require that when these are drawn, that it has to have at least seven counties within one area. But you'll see that in the next slide, we kind of zoom in a little bit, pretty stark differences along those lines, especially when you compare rating area 8 and rating area 1 and 3. Especially when you look at Scott and LeSueur County, Dakota, Rice, and Goodhue counties, you might be paying significantly more for your health insurance than your neighbor if they live across the street from you. So the next slide is kind of comparing national plans versus nonprofit plans here in Minnesota. The graphic there is from a national organization that represents all carriers in the market. They create this every year to kind of just show where costs are going every year. But it's a good comparison to kind of where we're at in the market. All plans have to meet a certain medical loss ratio, which I'll go here in a second. But medical expenses for national plans tend to be around 83 cents on the dollar of premiums collected. Around 14 cents of that goes to administrative. For our nonprofit plans, we're doing a little bit better on that. More money is being put into medical expenses on a lower administrative expense. The other big difference between us and kind of the larger national plans is the profit versus margin. The profit piece is, leftover is being sent into shareholders, stakeholders. For us, we don't have that. And so if we have margins, that will usually go into community benefit funds that we have established, or that money will go into reserves. And so why have reserves? It's the exact same reason why the state has a rainy day fund, why you may have a savings account where you put a little bit of extra money in every month, just to have that have money there in case an emergency happens. And the healthcare system is very in, things happen. We have this in case the unexpected happens. There's a large run on healthcare services, such as a pandemic happens. Or there's shifts in enrollment, which is kind of happening right now with the UCare insolvency, as well as unexpected changes in healthcare. Drug prices change frequently, new drugs come into the market, but money has to be there to pay claims. There's also reserves there to help bridge delays in government payments. All of our members who sit in the Medicaid market, there's a 2 months period of time where they are not paid for those services. It was a budgeting shift that was put in by the legislature decades ago. It's very similar to the school shift, if you're familiar with that. So there's 2 months there that plans are not paid and they have to use reserves to pay for that, as well as there's a delay with the reinsurance program. So not only is this sound economic policy, but it's also something that's required by regulators at the state and federal level. So one way to kind of look at market health is, as I mentioned, medical loss ratio. So this is a comparison between the claims that are coming in versus the premiums being collected. And so it's just a simple calculation of claims divided by premiums. And so if you have a medical loss ratio around 100%, that means you're breaking even. You're using every single bit of your premium to pay for the claims that are coming in. If you're above 100%, that means that you're not collecting enough premium, you're paying over in claims, and so you're either losing money or you're having to use reserves to pay for those costs. It's also required that insurers hold a medical loss ratio above 85%, meaning that they have to spend at least 85% of their premiums on care. Part of this came in part when the ACA was first developed. You may remember when that was first enacted that there was an individual mandate requiring that everybody have health insurance, or there would be a financial penalty to you. There was concern that if we were going to require everyone to have insurance, what's going to stop insurers from taking financial advantage of that requirement? And so, in part, the medical loss ratio was put in there to ensure that premiums you're collecting are being used for care and not being kept by the insurer. So there's a kind of a de facto cap on administrative costs for insurance companies. And so if you look over time, this is medical loss ratios dating back to 2013. The kind of unstableness of it all has to do with implementing the ACA, the reinsurance program coming into effect, and then the pandemic as well. So there's a period of time where there were significant losses to insurance carriers. Then there was a period of time where they were taking in too much premium, either due to figuring out how the reinsurance program would integrate, but also during COVID, we were taking in more premium because there was less utilization of care. That has kind of started to stabilize, but it has started to tick up a little bit here as healthcare costs continue to rise. And then, as I mentioned, if you go below that 85% threshold, that means you have to return money to the enrollees. This is a graph showing the rebates that have been sent back to those in the individual market. Again, that kind of mirrors the graph before, where plans went below that 85% and therefore had to return funds to enrollees. And this occurred pretty much during the anywhere from the 2017 to about 2022. This is not just a Minnesota thing. This happens in every state. This is a graph of all states. So we're a little bit lower than some states are in terms of rebating. This is not something we want to do, but it does provide financial assurances to those purchasing in that market. Beyond medical loss ratio, you can look at our financials, which we are required to send into the Department of Health, and they post that online every April. It has been a difficult year for our industry. There's been losses in the commercial market, which includes the individual market, but significant losses in Medicare and Medicaid, where our plans have obligations to deliver a certain amount of care in those markets, but payments from the federal government and state have not kept up with those obligations. And so why, as I kind of start to wrap up here, is the individual market so expensive? Well, part of it is a lack of subsidization. Early in the presentation, we talked about could be an employer or government program. If you're in one of those programs, your employer's paying the vast majority of your premium. If you're on a government program, either the federal and state government is paying for the most of your premium. There are premium tax credits that are available for those in 100 to 400% of poverty. And there was 1 year of premium subsidies from the state, but that was only for 2017. And then we have the reinsurance program that is also a subsidy. There's also state enacted requirements that the legislature may change, which fall primarily on this market in terms of coverage, prior authorization, and network adequacy requirements. But the biggest driver is healthcare costs. They continue to go up, and very significantly over the last few years. Not just the spending for hospitals and pharmaceuticals, but also post-COVID higher utilization as we move out of that period of time. But also inflation has started to hit the healthcare sector, which tends to hit them later than other sectors. And so where does all the money go? It's going to care. This graphic is from the American Medical Association, who puts out a report every year on healthcare spending. This is their most recent report from 2023. And you'll see that 90% of healthcare dollars are going towards care. 6.2% is being used to pay for insurance. This also includes things such as medical research and so forth. So, for us to really get a handle on lowering premiums for folks, it's ultimately the cost of care that we have to address. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson and Mr. Andreessen. I was wondering if you, well, I'll get to my questions later. Let's just go if there's member questions and things. We're going to go with Representative Kreischer, followed by Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I'm wondering, as I appreciate the overview, and I go back to this slide here, just kind of the whole market, but my question is, if you can help, if this is your opinion or if you've got some facts, but Minnesota Care a couple years ago had a surplus. Now they're looking at $84 million in liabilities, shutting their doors. We have this huge problem they have. How did they go from that surplus to $84 million in liabilities that rippled through the rest of the insurance market? What would be your opinion of the Department of Commerce responsibility in or failings in that? I mean, don't they have a job to make sure that happens? And if the Department of Commerce is here and wants to respond as well, but I'll start with you.
Which one of you wants that question? Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kreischer, when you say Minnesota Care, the Minnesota Care program?
Minnesota UCARE.
Oh, UCARE.
Thank you.
Okay. So they may be able to answer this better. So there is a response. All of our financials are being tracked by Commerce. MDH has a role as well as licensed HMOs. So I think there's been a recognition that there's been financial instability, especially in the Medicaid and Medicare markets. What has been happening behind the scenes, we're not privy to much of that information from the council standpoint. There is some financial information that we know, but we're also governed by antitrust regulations where we, you know, there's some of this going on. So I guess that's a long-winded answer that maybe the department could provide more information on that.
Representative Kreischer, follow-up.
Yeah, so obviously I'm not going to make this a huge grilling of the department, but I mean, just I understand where you're at and I understand the sensitivity of your answering this, but answer me this. Isn't it the Department of Commerce's responsibility to see those levels of risks and those uncertainties and to give guidance in preventing that type of scenario where you go from huge surpluses to insolvency? Isn't that why we have that department, in your opinion? I'm not putting words in your mouth, I'm asking.
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kreischer, I would say that one of the roles of the department is to kind of monitor our financials, both if we are doing too well or doing too poorly. That is kind of the role of their agency.
No further questions.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because I'm fairly new to this committee, I just want to get some definitions straight. When you say 90% of healthcare dollars, are you referring to the dollars that, like, we pay to our premiums or that you collect, or is it the money you pay out and the providers put 90% into healthcare? It's just a broad definition. I'm kind of wondering what that exactly is.
Ms. Olson, Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, that is total spending. So it's total spending by health insurers, government programs in both Medicare and Medicaid. So that isn't necessarily just premium spend. It's total spending across the entire healthcare sector in the United States.
Representative Hewitt, follow up.
Just real quick then. So that's total spending by the by you, or is it by the provider? Is it just everything? Yeah, I'm still having trouble tracking it. I'll look into it more and I'll talk to you offline. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Andreessen, did you want to do some follow up? And I saw you kind of shaking your head a little bit that maybe you had some additional information.
I'll just mention that, Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt. It's spending by all of us, whether it's in our premiums, it's your out-of-pocket cost, it's your taxes you pay that fund state programs. It's everything that's being spent on care.
Very good. Representative Kreischer's question about the charge of the department. We do have a representative from the department here who would like to respond to that. So if they would like to come forward, Mr. Smith from the department, maybe we can get a more definitive answer for Representative Kreischer. Mr. Smith, welcome to the committee, and if you will go ahead and state your name for the record, and if you would like, I can certainly go back and ask Representative Kreischer to restate the question if you'd like. Did you want her to restate the question?
Chair Driscoll, that would be appreciated. Thank you. But for the record, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Stand by. Representative Krusia, if you want to repeat your question for the representative from the department.
Sure can. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you for coming up. Again, just going through and looking at the situation that's in front of us with UCARE, watching it go from the surpluses to the $84 million liabilities and where they're at, I'm curious about what the role of the department played in that. But it just seems to be that monitoring should be there to help prevent these or to give some guidance on that. What we hear on this committee a lot is, sure, we have monitoring, and as Mr. Andreessen said, if someone's making too much money or they're not making enough, but all we ever hear here is if someone's doing too well, but when they're doing too poorly, that seems to just go away. So help clarify that for me if you could.
Mr. Smith.
Chair Driscoll, Representative Krusia, thank you for the question. The Department of Health has primary oversight over HMOs. We do provide some support to that department around the reviewing of financials. And you know, I will say, I think like everyone in this room, we were alarmed by the trajectory of UCARE and what that represented, you know, not just for a much loved health plan, but also the health insurance industry generally. And we, as an agency, worked together to identify the best path forward once it became clear that UCARE was no longer financially stable. And we were able to reach a resolution where Medica was able to acquire portions of UCARE, which I think represents a positive step forward for the industry going forward. I will say that the department is currently contemplating strategies to enhance our oversight to better avoid challenges around a situation like UCARE in the future, and hope to be sharing that information soon as part of the governor's budget, but at this time I can't comment on it.
Representative Krusia, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and this is not directed at you. I'm putting this together, but as I hear this and I hear what's gone on in the last however many years and use the word alarmed, members, we have the Department of Education, we have the Department of Commerce, we have the Department of Health. They are designed to look for these. And when I hear the word alarmed, the only analogy I can put is Paul Revere still sitting in the tavern drinking and go, I'm alarmed the British are coming and not doing a dang thing about it. My goodness, the sole reason this administration has these tools and have these people is to get on your damn horse and ride through the town and tell us things are falling apart. But hey, let's just take another pint and say we're alarmed at what's happening around us. I respect all the work you're doing, but my goodness, when test fire after test fire comes up, well, we saw this coming. My goodness. And then I'm just going to do this and be done, but I hear Mr. Evans up there who said in the fraud thing, you know what, the money's already gone, it's out the door, there isn't a thing we can do, now we're going into other things. You know what? UCARE is already failing. It's out the door, $84 million liabilities. But we're alarmed. Let's prevent one in the future. So I think that's what this committee is supposed to do, is help these commerce departments, other ones. But so I'm sorry for the little tirade, but, well, actually, I'm really not sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krusia, for the record, your reference of Paul Revere in the tavern. Tuesday of next week is the liquor bill. It's not today.
I'll be on the horse riding from
here. Representative Finke, you have the next question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifiers, I actually do appreciate Representative Krusia's remarks, because I think that something that I notice in the world right now in politics is that, you know, people can say the same thing exactly word for word to two different audiences and hear the exact opposite thing. So I have a question about for the testifiers, and then I want to come back. But we have 180,000 people in this market. The market's not succeeding, right? This is a marketplace that is failing, as we just heard. The marketplace is failing, according to your own presentation, because it doesn't have enough subsidies. It offers too much health care, right? You need fewer requirements and mandates, which is health care options. And the cost is going to increase of healthcare, right? Those are the three reasons we're given, right? You need more subsidies. We need to offer less healthcare. Healthcare is too expensive. So I want to know, I'm asking for your opinion or whatever, but like, what do you want to do about it? Is it reinsurance forever? Is it what? What do we do to prop this small and failing market into the future?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Finke, I would say a couple answers to that. Ultimately, it comes down to the cost of care, and until we start addressing that, all markets are going to have trouble. You're going to have trouble with what you are getting from your employer. Even though your employer provides most of your premium, they are shifting more and more to out-of-pocket costs and higher deductibles. The same issue is happening in the Medicare Medicaid markets, where federal and state governments are struggling to pay for the care for the individual in that market. And then it just happens with the individual market, it falls a little bit more on the individual themselves because there isn't that subsidization. So fixing healthcare costs is something we've been working on, you know, as long as I've been alive. But we need to start doing something instead of just waiting. But in terms of this market, you know, reinsurance is working, so we would say, yes, let's keep it going until we can figure out a different solution, because it's the only way that we can actually subsidize that market. But it's just kind of, it's a market, unless you figure out a way you're going to give these folks other options, it's kind of the way we're in right now with this market.
Representative, can you follow up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I appreciate the honesty, right, because I'm also new to this committee. I remember last year kind of learning how the reinsurance program operates and just being absolutely baffled that this is the thing that we are doing. Like, I understand it, and I learned, and I was told convincingly why we need insurance as a sort of short-term program, but like the idea of reinsurance as a programmatic solution to a market that is this desperately failing, right? Like, the people who are here need to have access to healthcare. That's the purpose of health insurance, right? And I mean, it's not to make money. I know there's some disagreement about that, but it's to provide healthcare. And this presentation that you have just given, I think, is word for word an excellent presentation for the reason why this market needs to be gone. It's failing. We have options. There are alternatives. You can hear the frustration on the other side. You can hear the frustration on our side. What we do is obviously not going to be the same solution, right? Like, we have a vision of how everyone can have health care, and it's, you know, as Representative Cretia said, maybe we need to empower the Commerce Department to solve these problems a little more, which is, I think, a wonderful solution, because the market's not taking care of this. So let's figure out perhaps an alternative way, because market, you know, and barring a miracle, healthcare costs aren't going to go down under the system that we currently have built. Reinsurance is wildly expensive, and it's subsidizing a failing market. Like, when did that become the preferred solution of, you know, conservative members of the caucus? Like, we suddenly are wanting to prop up with subsidies a market that's not serving its purpose. I mean, this presentation, word for word, is a perfect argument for single-payer health care. So that's my take. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke. We will now move on to Representative Dotseth, followed by Representative Elkins. Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. I will just kind of rephrase Representative Finke's question. Magically, I actually had a very similar question. The question I have for our testifiers today was, if you had a magic wand, what would be three things that we could actually do to actually help get health care more affordable again?
Uh-oh, here we go. This is the goose that lays the golden egg this morning. Representative Andreessen. I'm sorry to offend you. Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dossett. When we need to reevaluate what we pay for a care, are we overpaying? There's, you know, a lot of discussion about there is, you know, how much do other countries pay for pharmaceuticals, as well as providers. Do we need to invest more in preventative care? The best way to save healthcare is to not use it at all. But what do we need to do to incentivize healthier lifestyles so that we can avoid longer-term problems down the road. I think that's probably the best two I can come up with immediately.
Representative Vassa, follow-up.
I appreciate your transparency on that. I think that's something us as legislators can start looking at and start looking at alternative options that we can do to help get affordable health care as we move forward.
Representative Elkins, you have the next question, followed by Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair. Mr. Andreessen, can you go back to slide 20? Okay, so everybody's fumbling. So I've actually had this data for a while just because I'm a data geek and I'm really pushy about getting my hands on the data. Consider what I'm about to say to be informed opinion on my part, but one thing I would first draw your attention to, and this goes back to Representative Kreisch's line of questioning, look at the columns for Medicare and Medicaid. Okay. So Medicare is only federally regulated. Medicaid is negotiated with the Department of Health and Human Services. That's where the losses were. So the part of the market that is regulated by Commerce is the first column where there were losses, but they were relatively modest, and UCARE's losses, UCARE cumulatively for 2024 had $600 million in losses, but only $21 million of their losses were in the commercial market. So what I think happened with UCARE, again, this is just an informed opinion on my part based on the digging that I've done, is that Medicare, especially Medicare Advantage, has long been viewed as a cash cow, and it was until suddenly in 2024 it wasn't. And so you see for UCARE a $267.4 million loss on Medicare. From 23 to 24, Humana pulled in their horns. They dropped a whole bunch of unprofitable Medicare Advantage plans in different counties. UCARE went after that business, and it turns out there was a reason why Humana dropped out of those markets. In the case of Medicaid, all of the carriers lost a bunch of money on Medicaid. I think what happened there is that we were coming out of the great Medicaid unwind. I think that for a few years, the carriers were probably benefiting by the fact that there were a bunch of people enrolled in Medicaid who had actually moved on and were getting their insurance elsewhere, and so they were benefiting from receiving capitated payments on members that weren't really members. And then all of a sudden, with the end of the great Medicaid rewind in 2024, you had a more accurate membership, and so suddenly you weren't getting those extra capitated payments anymore, and the capitated payments weren't nearly enough to cover the actual expenses that that were being incurred by the members who remained. And so the just all of the carriers lost their butts in Medicare in 2024. And I think what happened to UCARE in particular is that by the time the 2025 rates were set, this had not, the magnitude of these 2024 results had not been recognized. The rates weren't adjusted adequately. And basically UCARE blew through half their reserves in 2024. The other half in 2025, and consequently, they're no longer around. And that's why carriers have reserves, and why regardless of who your regulator are, you have to be prudent in your actuarial analysis. And the actuarial analysis for Medicaid and 2024 was very difficult to do because of the unwind, and so this is where we're at. Question for Mr. Andreessen.
Sure. Yeah.
When will the 2025 numbers like this be available?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, in April.
April, okay. I think it will be when this chart can be reproduced for 2025, I think it will be really revealing.
Anything else, Representative Elkins?
No, thank you.
All right, we'll go to Representative Reimer, followed by Representative Binsbergen, and then Representative Smith. Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, testifiers, for being here today. Mr. Andreessen, on page 5 of the presentation, enrollment in the individual market, you know, obviously, I believe 2014 was when the individual mandate took effect from Obamacare, and I'm wondering, what accounts for that kind of precipitous drop-off between 2014 and 2017? And then where did, more importantly, where did those people go? Do we have an understanding of if they're not in the individual market, are they getting on a Medicaid subsidized plan? Are they enrolling in MinCare? Did we just have a bunch of people find jobs with health insurance? Where did those people go?
Mr. Andreessen. Ms. Olson.
So, as we discussed previously, when the ACA was first passed, there was a federal reinsurance program that was passed alongside that, which helped subsidize the cost to each of the states. That was then phased out. And so as that phased out, you see that drop in enrollment because premiums were increasing. And when it steadies out, that's when the emergency subsidy, one-time subsidy and reinsurance were put into place. In terms of where folks went, some folks chose not to purchase health insurance and were uninsured. Some folks were, they had life changes and maybe were able to go to public programs. Some may have received provider, their insurance through an employer. But I don't think we have a good chart of drawing out exactly where folks landed.
Representative Reimer, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, maybe just a comment that I agree with what Representative Finke had said to a certain extent, that there has to be kind of a reimagining of this, but I think it's worth noting you can't change the past, but you can only work with what you have going forward. And obviously reinsurance was introduced when Obamacare happened and premiums were skyrocketing and it was pitched as a temporary solution, and it's become this thing that we just bake in, because otherwise, as we saw in the presentation, premiums are going to not increase 30%, they're going to increase 50-55%. So I'm all for reimagining how we do this thing going forward. I hopefully will be here next session and we can have those conversations with all stakeholders. But it's worth noting that Obamacare was a nuclear bomb on our healthcare system. It was. We had a high-risk pool that was working well. We had a thriving private market that was serving as many people as it possibly could, and premiums were not increasing like we're seeing them right now. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Reimer. And we're going to go down to Representative Van Binsbergen, followed by Representative Smith. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Van Binsbergen, if you could go a little closer to the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for bringing this into the agenda today. This is an issue that is facing, by you can hear by the testimony around this table today, this is an issue that is facing each one of our districts. I am of great concern. I've spent last night talking to people about their insurance rates. I spent this morning at 7 o'clock on a Zoom call talking to people about their rates. A number that sticks in my mind of one reason why our rates are where they are is 71. I heard the number 71 mandates onto this market that have taken place. Well, of course rates are going to be high when we've mandated this to insurance companies. 71 mandates, and I see the bills and the laws that come out of this, out of the House and out of the Senate. Great concern to me and my constituents. Question I have is on the, we're talking about the individual market today, and I know this is maybe a little out of your territory, but the small and large group, have they seen consistent increases in premium like the individual market?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Binsbergen, yes, I would say that I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. I think they were a little bit less, but they were double-digit increases for the small group this year. They tend to kind of follow along the same path because they're even though one is bought through an insurer, one is bought or through your employer, one is bought on your own. They're both in fully insured markets. They're not self-insured plans. So they kind of follow the same path in terms of state regulations, what they're covering, and they're all subject to the same health care cost drivers that we have.
Representative Binsberg, and final follow-up.
Sure. You also talked about cost of doing business in different parts of the state. And, you know, I was just kind of looking at my area, and can you highlight a little more detail on that?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I think this way I would put it is that when you're, as a health plan, when you're setting up your networks of providers and hospitals and so forth, you're going out and negotiating with that entity as to what is the price, best price that we can get to, what that we will be paying you for your services in terms, in regard to your services you're providing. When you're in an area where there's a lot of competition, a lot of different hospitals, you're able to use that in terms of your negotiating power. If you are negotiating rates in a county where there's just one hospital, one provider, and we have in the state network adequacy laws that state that you have to contract with certain providers in certain areas, they know that we have to contract with them. And so they have more leverage in that negotiating with that, and also that they're essentially the sole person there. And so it tends to be more expensive there. And if it's more expensive, that means that we have to collect more premium. And if we're collecting more premium, then the folks that are likely buying that product are sicker as opposed to healthier, and you need the healthier folks in there to bring down the cost. And so that's why I would say it's difficult to manage a policy in those areas.
Representative Smith, then followed by Representative Faulkner. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. This is a pretty dour presentation about the status of the individual market, amongst other things. On slide 4 in your presentation, the biggest provider in the individual market is Blue Plus, which is under the banner of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. This is in 2024. In that same year, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota paid their CEO $4.3 million, which is a 34% increase over compensation from the previous year. Can you explain to the people of Minnesota, a market that is already heavily subsidized, why the largest provider can continue to increase the pay of their chief executives 34% while also raising their premiums 18%?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, two answers to that question. One is you have the medical loss ratios, which already state that we can't keep more than 15% of the premiums that we spend. Otherwise, we have to give it back to you. Second, these are difficult jobs. And there was a report on CEO compensation a year or so ago in the Star Tribune. And that analysis found that executive compensation accounted for 0.05% of total expenditures. So I know when we look at numbers like this, there is some concern over it. But I would say that it's a very small amount of what the premium dollars you're putting in. It's pennies. But these are difficult jobs. You mentioned Blue Cross. They're covering the greatest share of lives in the state. Health Partner CEO is not only running an insurance company, but they're also running a hospital system. Medica is involved in insurance in this state as well as other states. So these are difficult jobs, and you want folks there who can do the job.
Representative Smith, follow-up.
This is not just a question coming from me. I hear this all the time, that this system is broken. And that's true for the people who are receiving care, who are trying to get care, who are trying to get coverage, who are paying more, not just in their premiums, but in their co-pays for their medications, for their deductibles, and are seeing skyrocketing prices. But it is working for one group of people, and it is the executives in the C-suite. And I know this is a nonprofit, but in other markets for shareholders. I echo a lot of sentiments that have been said today that this system is broken, that there are better ways to do it. We know there are better ways around the world that this is done, that entrusting it to companies that are able to pay their CEOs a 34% increase while regular Minnesotans are struggling to even go to the doctor for a physical. Thanks, Chair.
You're welcome. And Representative Faulkner.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation, this information. I mean, I agree with a lot of what people have been saying, you know, across both sides. Like Representative Finke said, you can hear the frustration that we have in all of this. And I agree with Representative Krisha, you know, we need to sound the alarm. This system is broken. I mean, healthcare is on the rise, plan costs are on the rise, medications cost too much, like Mr. Andreessen said. Deductibles keep rising, even though premiums keep rising. Coinsurance kicks in, so you pay another percentage after you meet the deductible. I mean, it's just everything about healthcare is just becoming more and more unaffordable for Minnesotans. I agree with Representative Finke. I mean, I think we are marching toward the inevitability that we're going to need a statewide single-payer plan. I mean, we all benefit from the state health plan that we get, or at least you have access to it. Larger pool, unrestricted border in the plan. You're going to absorb costs more. You can absorb the cost of the mandates more. I mean, on the point of the mandates, I mean, the other body discussed this yesterday. The price increases on premiums are relatively negligible for most of the mandates, at least the ones that I had a short time to look up. I mean, hair for cancer patients rose premiums by 13 cents, whereas ending the advanced premium tax credits rose premiums on an average of $177. So, I mean, there's the fact that we're reliant on taxpayer subsidized money to make healthcare affordable. Why don't we just get rid of all this insurance part, these inefficient sets of plans that have small pools that can't pay for the risk or the cost associated, and just go with the statewide model? I mean, it's just, if this system's failing rapidly, 116,000 Minnesotans don't have insurance at all. 180,000 in this market that's failing. Businesses have to pay a lot to cover their employees, and then the employees are still on the hook for these deductibles. We're just, yeah, right. It's a dour situation that we're facing. And as a committee, we got to figure out how to do this better. I'm just wondering, I guess, just kind of with all of this, the single biggest increase that we've seen to the premium increases this year is due to the Fed's saving $35 billion by cutting the advanced tax credit. Then we, you know, that obviously we know we just chose to go to war with Iran, costing $1 billion a day. Were you lobbying Congress, being like, hey, you know, this is going to be bad for Minnesotans, for our clients, keep this? Like, were you part of the discussion of, like, trying to push back at least on behalf of Minnesotans?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falconer, yes, we were supporting very vocally the extension of the premium tax credits, even up to the end, saying even if you weren't going to do it immediately, at least reevaluate and try to put it in mid-year. Those were proven to keep people in the market, especially the younger, healthier folks that we need to have in there to help bring down premiums.
Thank you.
Representative Faulkner.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I think most of us were pretty shocked that Congress, maybe it's my naivety, I thought Congress would actually extend that. Seems to be political suicide from the presidential administration to have thrown this cost onto Minnesotans. But here we are, and we got to solve this. So I don't have much more other than just expressing extreme frustration, and I know that frustration is shared. Maybe solutions are different, but we're not doing right by Minnesotans with this current system. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for your very thoughtful and respectful discussion today. I said I would leave my comments till the end, and so I'd like to share some thoughts and some reactions, having been around this market and around this topic for a while. First and foremost, I think the words reinsurance somehow have gotten a negative connotation, the concept of reinsurance. The insurance industry has had reinsurance in many different areas for centuries. And basically what happens if you go downtown St. Paul or you go downtown Minneapolis or you go to a lot of different places, the buildings that are there, no one insurance company really carries all the coverage on that. You may have multiple carriers that are insuring that building because of risk management, or you may have a primary insurance policy on that. And that company has then gone out and taken some of the premiums they've received from the building owner and bought a policy to protect themselves in the case of catastrophic loss. So this concept of reinsurance has actually been very successful in many different aspects in the insurance industry. So I don't want the term reinsurance to become demified as somehow it's the big bad, problem monster in the room. It's not. It's a great concept that works in the insurance industry. The other thing that I don't know if our testifiers have any background or can add any context to this, but the amount of uncompensated care that is out there right now is growing exponentially. And when we talk about uncompensated care, it's not like it's a magic, not existent number and we can just brush it off of the books. It is actual dollars that have been paid for medical supplies, for medical treatment, for doctors, nurses, practitioners, technicians, et cetera, to provide health services for individuals. And then what happens is that individual does not have the resources to pay for that, and then becomes the uncompensated care for the hospitals and the clinics. Too much uncompensated care, not to borrow too many metaphors from yesterday, but again, straw that breaks the camel's back on the process. We have been playing catch up in this state ever since the Affordable Care Act went into place. Prior to that, Minnesota was the crown jewel and envy of the nation in the way that we provided health insurance in the individual market. We had a law that we passed in this legislature and in this state some 50 years ago called the MCHA, Minnesota Comprehensive Health Insurance Act. And that created what we now have as MCHA. But the MCHA that we're talking about today is a mere ghost and skeleton of what the work that MCHA had done as a result of that. It created the MCHIP program, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Insurance Program. And you went to a carrier and you applied. And if you were rejected, you took your rejection letter, you brought it to the MCHA folks, and what they did is they spun you out to another carrier. You paid higher premiums. And what we did is we rebalanced at the end of each year. It's a great program. As a matter of fact, in 1993, Hillary Clinton, First Lady of the United States, spent about 3 to 4 weeks here learning about this. What's going on in Minnesota? What are they doing? Why is this working so well? Because the Clinton administration wanted to attack this issue as well. What are we going to do with these rising costs? Our state has been playing catch-up ever since then. We had some discussion earlier and in this biennium, and we had some discussion as well here recently about reauthorizing the reinsurance program and applying for a federal waiver on here. And I heard some of my colleagues today talk about the end of the federal tax credits on here. Folks, call it what you will. That's just money that's not being used as a reinsurance program. It's cutting it off the top instead of the back end of the expenses for people. So these two things, I think, are hand in glove. You can't say one's good, the other's bad. They both provide the same outcome, lower premiums for people. And so I would hope that we would not demify one over the other or say one is good because the federal government is doing it and the other one is bad because the state of Minnesota is doing it. If our true goal is to provide a system that works for Minnesotans, then we may need a combination of things. So I don't want us to say one is good, the other is bad. And the reason those federal tax credits came is they started seeing premiums go up, and a way for the federal government to participate in this was to offer those credits to folks in a certain income range. And it's always better when there's more people at the table to be able to help share those costs, whether it's the individual, whether it's a health insurance entity. And the way you get a health insurance is you have to pay the premiums right now. And so what we need to do is we need to make sure that we stabilize that part of the process and make sure that we're in good shape. What wasn't discussed today that I think just bears a couple of minutes of note is we also have the supplemental market for Medicare. And with the supplemental market, we saw UCare has been mentioned where they were no longer in the marketplace. They not only were out in the individual market when they exited, they also exited the Medicare supplements. And that happened at the end of last year. Literally in about 90 days before the first of this year, people were scrambling to try to find Medicare coverage in the form of supplements, I should say, with other carriers. A couple hundred thousand people in the state of Minnesota trying to find care coverage, right? That shifted this burden from multiples to rolling it up to a few others taking that. So this is not just in the individual market. It's not just in one area. There are lots of contributing factors on here. Uncompensated care, higher costs and premiums, no federal. Who knows what we're going to do in the future as far as reinsurance. We own what we can, and we own some of this, and we should do what we can to help manage this part of the process as Minnesotans, elected by Minnesotans, to take care of Minnesotans. So I just wanted to share some of that background with folks. And the last thing I'm going to mention to you as well is if you're going to try to run a medical clinic on Medicare reimbursement, you're not going to be around very long, because the cost that Medicare reimburses is substantially less than the actual cost of providing the coverage for the care that individuals need. If we were to actually try to bring cost of care and the subsidy in line, people would be taking massive cuts in pay. We would be in a much dire situation. So that's part of the problem that we don't have direct control over as Minnesotans. And so again, I thank you for your very thoughtful and respectful discussion. It's much appreciated, and that's the goal of this committee, is to have that kind of discussion, to search out and to find answers. And with that, because we do have two other bills, we're going to end our discussion today on this, and we're going to now ask Representative Allen to come forward, and we're going to take House File 3437. And I will bring that before the committee. And at this time, we're going to hear the bill. And I know there's a little bit of additional work that needs to probably be done on this. And we're going to lay this bill over for a couple of meetings until we can get some of the questions resolved. But with that, Representative Allen, I will ask you to go ahead. We do have the bill before us in the committee, to go ahead and to speak to your bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll and Chair Cagle. Thanks for the opportunity to be able to bring this bill forward, HF 3437, and for hearing it today. This bill is about one thing, and that's financing options for those who are looking to make real estate investments for themselves. This bill removes the caps, prepayment penalties, as well as financing closing costs or lender fees for those who are looking to run non-owner occupied investment property. These caps that are placed are different than our surrounding states, and when lifted, it'll make it easier for small local investors to compete with out-of-state cash buyers. With me today is Mike Steidem, and Director of Regulatory Affairs at Rocket Mortgage, to explain the bill in more detail.
Good morning and welcome to the committee. Phil, state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Again, for the record, my name is Michael Steidem. I am the Director of Regulatory Affairs with Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage appreciates the opportunity to provide testimony in support of the proposed amendments to the Minnesota Mortgage Originator and Servicer License Statute, which would specify that finance lender fee cap and prepayment penalty restrictions are only for consumer purpose loans. House File 3437 will address two restrictions broadly impacting both consumer purpose and business purpose mortgages. The amendments will specify these restrictions only apply to consumer purpose mortgages. The first restriction the bill addresses is the 5% limit on finance lender fees. Under current Minnesota law, lenders are not allowed to include a lender fee in the principal amount of a residential mortgage in excess of 5% of the loan amount to be financed. And we agree that while the protections regarding lender fee financing for personal, family, or household purposes, collectively consumer purpose loans, are important, the ability to finance these closing costs, including lender fees, can be a beneficial option for real estate investors looking using a business purpose mortgage loan. This frees up how much capital is needed to come to the closing table, which will make it easier for smaller investors to start or continue investing. The second restriction the bill addresses is the limitation on prepayment penalties. Under current Minnesota law, prepayment penalties are limited to being charged within the first 42 months after closing and cannot exceed the lesser of 2% of the outstanding balance or 60 days worth of interest. We agree prepayment penalties charged on consumer purpose loans can cause an undue financial burden on consumers. However, a prepayment penalty can be a beneficial tool for borrowers looking to obtain more favorable upfront pricing on business purpose mortgage loans. Specifically, loans with a prepayment penalty typically receive lower upfront pricing, a lower rate or origination fees, where loans without a prepayment penalty are priced higher to offset lower potential returns if a loan is paid in full earlier than anticipated. Prepayment penalties are a great tool for keeping monthly payments lower for those who are planning on holding their investment property, reducing house flipping, and increasing stability in the housing market. And these amendments in the language also bring Minnesota in alignment with its neighboring states, Iowa, North and South Dakota, and Wisconsin, who do not limit prepayment penalties for business purpose loans. House File 3437 would retain the 5% limit on finance lender fees and a limit on prepayment penalties to be charged within the first 42 months for consumer purpose loans. It will allow real estate investors the option to finance these closing costs and have the option to agree to a prepayment penalty beyond 42 months to obtain more favorable pricing on, again, business purpose mortgage loans. And then lastly, we want to thank other stakeholders that have given us feedback on the proposal. We are working with legal aid on crafting some language that ensures our goal of lifting the financing cap and prepayment penalty limitation for those who wish to invest while still protecting personal and family use mortgages. And we look forward to incorporating that feedback for the belt and suspenders protection into the final version of the bill. So that concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. I do not have anyone else that has signed up in advance to testify. Is there anyone present who would like to speak to the matter from the public? We'll get to member questions here in just a little bit. Anybody from the public wishing to speak on the matter? Mr. Elwood, you don't have to come to the testifying table if you don't want to, but your organization was cited in here. You certainly are welcome to come up and make comments if you'd like to on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I do really appreciate Rocket Mortgage and certainly the author for coming to us, asking our views on this bill. We certainly don't want to restrict options in the marketplace for investment purposes, but as was stated, we are definitely want to make sure that we have it tight enough so that residential owner-occupied homes are not jeopardized under certain circumstances. We had several cases in which this issue sort of arose, and we just want to make it tight. And we're very appreciative of the author and the proponents working with us, and we look forward to providing language that will make this bill for us fine. Thank you so much for allowing me the few minutes to chat today.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. And to the three of you, do you think you're going to be able to find Representative Davis' favorite cliche, peace in the valley, on this?
Mr. Chair, that is the intention and the hope. So.
Okay, very good. And that's why we're laying it over to give you gentlemen the opportunity to be able to maybe come to that magical spot. So before we move to the next. Is there anyone else in the public that would like to testify in the matter before the committee? House File 3437. Seeing none, hearing none, we'll go to member questions. Any member questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, I have a question for the representative from Rocket Mortgage. So the problem in the market this is addressing, I believe, is either out-of-state or larger cash offers, right, which is a problem in our home market generally. And it's a a large problem, especially for new home buyers, especially for our limited housing market, especially in certain areas of the state. This obviously won't fix that. It's not focusing on that. What it's focusing on is allowing maybe investors more locally who can't do a large cash offer get a loan to be able to compete with those cash offers, right? And in the marketplace, that makes sense. But this is a very limited marketplace. So I have a twofold question that maybe will answer each other. One is, you mentioned Iowa, surrounding states already have guidelines in place that are similar to this bill. Could you describe those marketplaces, how often these kinds of loans are utilized in those different geographic locations? And secondly, kind of as a corollary to that, is there any danger of, even though these are better competitors than large cash offers, more competition for either first-time homeowners or people who are buying for that, personal use of a home?
Yeah, I'll address the second question, because that's near and dear to our hearts as well. And the reason I say that is because I have two young men who've both graduated from school, and they're wondering how can I afford to buy my first home. We are definitely focused on that. Our mission is to help everyone home, and that can look different for different individuals. There are definitely those who are dreaming to buy their first home, and we're very laser focused on looking at the housing affordability issue. But there are also those that are not in a position or not wanting to buy a home, and they are they're more content with renting a home. And that's my older son. He doesn't want to have the responsibility. He doesn't want to be tied, and he wants to be able to rent to where he wants to rent. So again, we're just trying to make it more competitive for the smaller individual real estate investor to have an opportunity to be able to compete with, like you said, some of those out-of-state larger firms that come in here with cash offers. And then your second question was around the neighboring states, right? These business purpose loans have been around for about a decade, so they're not new. But, we took a look at it because we finally went into the market ourselves in November with a business purpose loan. And the reason we did that is because we had some consumers reaching out to us saying, hey, I'm looking for this product, but I don't see that you offer it. And we got enough of those consumers to say, I think it's time for us to get into the market, because typically before we jumped in, it was more of a depository kind of product, a banking product. But we definitely see this as a product that's on the rise. It allows, in a lot of cases, it allows that entrepreneur an opportunity to, buy a rental property or two and start that generational wealth that they want to create for their families. And we also see that some of these folks that want to begin to buy a rental property, they're more self-employed. They don't have access to 401k loans, not 401k loans, but 401k for the retirement. And this is an opportunity for them to build that passive income to sustain themselves as they, continue with their career. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Smith.
Yeah,
very quickly. I don't mean to rush you.
Sure.
But we do have another bill. We got three testifiers for Representative.
Okay, then I'll be brief. I do think Representative Allen. Generally, I think that this could be like, glad you brought it forward. Glad we're going to continue to work on this. So thank you for answering those questions.
And again, Representative Smith, we're going to lay it over. So if you do have some other pressing questions, I know that these gentlemen would be happy to visit with you.
Yeah.
Thank you for your questions, though. Any other member questions? Seeing none, Representative Allen, we will give you the final word before we lay the bill over, and wish you and the others well in coming to the final solution.
Again, thank you for hearing this bill today. Like we said earlier, this is about giving people options in the market to be able to get into rental or business or property ownership in a different manner. Thank you to Legal Aid for the continued support and help on trying to get this bill into a workable form. And thank you, members, for listening to this today.
And with that, thank you, Representative Allen, and to your presenter. And with that, we'll lay the bill over. And we'll now go to our final bill, Representative Katiza Watoon's House File 4118. And we'll bring that before the committee at this time. And as Representative Katiza Watoon makes her way to the testifying table, we'll ask Mr. Smith and Mr. Rempe to both come toward the testifying table, just in the interest of time, to make sure that we're going to be able to answer any member questions that might exist. Representative Katiza Watoon, welcome to the committee. You're here every day. We love having you a part of the team. With that, I will move that House File 4118 be considered for re-referral to the Ways and Means Committee. And with that, we'll go ahead and give you the opportunity to set the bill up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, every day for the last 8 years. and it's been a fun ride. House File 4118 is a relatively simple bill, members. What it does is allow Minnesota credit unions to opt into insurance that's provided through a private provider. Essentially, you know, we're all familiar with FDIC-backed deposits in banking, and credit unions have to do a very similar thing through the credit union insurance. And right now, at the federal level, there's a three-member board that oversees credit union finances, and there are currently only one member on that board. Two of the other members have been dismissed earlier in 2025, and so while they're not able to make some pretty significant changes or decisions at the federal level because of the waiting on those appointees, it just really seems like this is a no-nonsense, simple solution to provide additional options for credit unions here in Minnesota. 10 other states already have this opportunity, and there hasn't been any opposition, and basically we're just trying to provide them another opportunity to make sure that the funds from people across the state are insured.
Very good. Thank you. With that, we'll go to your first testifier, Mr. Smith. If you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Ryan Smith from the Minnesota Credit Union Network, just here in support of House File 4118, and want to thank Representative Katisa-Watoon and Representative Allen for carrying the bill. And to Representative Katisa-Watoon's point, there's a little bit of upheaval right now with the federal level. The National Credit Union Administration serves as both our primary federal regulator and as our primary insurer. And there's a little bit of upheaval right now with the NCUA. And so this issue, it's as Representative Katisa-Watoon said, private insurance is an option in 10 other states. This is a long-proven ability for credit unions to opt for either additional insurance or sole insurance through a private provider. So we think it's important to have a little bit more certainty. We're hearing from more of our members just with upheaval at the federal level to have a ready option in place just in the event that there's any concerns has definitely put a little bit more urgency on this issue. But I also do want to make sure that we're making note here that private share insurance, there's the possibility of going beyond what current federal insurance guidelines are. Currently, the NCUA insures members up to $250,000, much like the FDIC is. Going to a private share insurance model actually allows for it to be $250,000 guaranteed per account. So that could be, you know, 401k, et cetera, like go all the way down the account. So it actually provides the ability for even further protection for credit union members across the state. We have worked hand in hand with the Department of Commerce on crafting this language. We just want to make sure that our members have the optionality to provide what they think is the best possible insurance coverage for their members. And so that's what we're here asking for you today. As Representative Katisa-Watoon said, we have talked with our friends at the banks. We have talked with consumer groups. We haven't heard any opposition to this. We think it's a good common sense solution to a potential problem, but also, again, just to provide optionality for us. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll leave off for other testifiers, but I will stick around for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Remke, I think we're going to have you move over to where Mr. Smith was because we did have a technical issue with that mic, but I wanted to save that walking and travel time for you. Now we have one other testifier who's going to be joining us by Zoom before we go to public testimony and member questions. Mr. Remke, if you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman and members. My name is Brent Remke. I am President and CEO of First Alliance Credit Union in Rochester, Minnesota. And I'm here to speak in support of House File 4118. Consumer confidence in insured institutions, insured deposit institutions are paramount to our financial system. And HF 4118 offers a strong alternative to federal NCUA insurance, keeping the existing $250,000 in insurance requirement intact. And as Mr. Smith testified to, it actually enhances it in many cases. This bill provides an option to state-chartered credit unions like First Alliance, so we're able to meet the requirement through either the federal program or through the private program. And this private program, it will be continuously supervised by the Minnesota Department of Commerce. So the safety and soundness of credit unions like ours and the protection of our members' deposits would continue to be oversight, and it would not weaken standards or oversight. From an operational standpoint, we're not looking to, we're just continuing to do prudent risk management, and it's a fair question to ask, why would a credit union CEO like myself consider this? It's not about taking on more risk, it's about managing risk. As credit unions are facing continually planning across economic cycles, regulatory changes, and balance sheet pressures that have evolved over the decade, and just having the option to evaluate a different, well-regulated insurance structure allows us to make sure our member deposits are safe with our specific risk profile, growth strategy, and capital planning. It gives our board and management flexibility to respond for costs, coverage terms, and systematic pressure changes in ways that could affect our long-term stability. So importantly, just want to reiterate, this does not affect the safety of our members' deposits. Deposits would remain insured at exactly the same federal levels or even enhanced levels over federal NCUA insurance. And any decision to pursue private insurance would only be made at First Alliance and our regulator, which is the Minnesota Department of Commerce. We're confident it met regulatory and rigorous safety and soundness standards. So again, that ability to choose between well-regulated insurance models can strengthen resilience by diversifying risk and avoiding over-reliance on the federal system. Ultimately, this bill would allow credit unions like First Alliance to responsibly evaluate the best way to protect members while remaining strong, stable, and well-managed. And for those reasons, I support HF-4188 and appreciate the committee's careful consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Rempe. And our final testifier is going to be via Zoom, Mr. Kurt Lewis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kurt Lowe. I serve as Chief Operating Officer at American Share Insurance, or ASI. ASI is a credit union-owned guarantee fund that operates across multiple states and insures over $20 billion in deposits that are held by more than 1.25 million credit union members. Since our founding in 1974, no member has ever lost money in an ASI-insured deposit account. The protection of member deposits and the stability of the financial institutions that we insure must always come first. That principle has remained central to ASI's mission and the operating model throughout our 50-plus year history. ASI operates with a very strong regulatory framework. We operate in the state of Ohio and are regulated by both the Ohio Department of Commerce and the Ohio Department of Insurance, while the credit unions that we insure remain supervised and regulated by their respective state credit union authorities. Our financial statements are audited on an annual basis by a Big Four accounting firm, and our reserves are attested to by an independent actuary each year. Today, ASI operates across 10 states and provides this important option for credit unions to choose an alternative other than being mandated with the federal program. We operate under strong regulatory oversight with robust reserves and conservative risk management practices. Our focus remains on the protection of member deposits and the financial stability of the institution and this credit union industry as a whole. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about the private deposit insurance model.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. If we have questions, we'll come back to you. That concludes the list of people we have that signed up to testify. Is there anyone from the public here today wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 4118. Seeing none, hearing none, member questions. We maybe have time for one or two member questions before we toss it back to Representative Katizu-Attune for the wrap-up. Seeing no member questions, Representative Allen, you are a co-author. I'd certainly want to hear from you as well. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if anybody wants to hear from me, but they're going to. So.
Okay, we'll give you 1 minute. How's that sound?
I would urge its passage. It's a great bill. The nice thing about it gives credit unions options in terms of where they get their insurance from, and more importantly, it's a bill that's been passed in several states that are Republican-held states and Democrat-held states, whether it's Alabama, California, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Maryland, Montana, or Nevada. It's a great bill, and I urge it to move on. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Allen, for co-authoring it with Representative Katiza-Watoon. And with that, we'll give you the final word, Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to my testifiers today. I did just want to ask you, Mr. Chair, a quick question. I know you had asked the Commerce Department yesterday if we were anticipating the fiscal note, and was curious on whether or not your motion to move to WAYS was dependent on that. Like, we're thinking that there may still be a fiscal cost, but to my knowledge, that's not expected at all. So I just wanted to clarify.
Great question, Representative Katiza-Watoon. I think we're going to send it to Ways and Means, even though we were told there wasn't a fiscal note. That keeps the bill moving, and then we can do a re-referral if necessary, or they can pass it out saying we don't need it. I think it keeps the bill moving in a glide path that that committee or another committee, they can handle it and move it out if they need to once we get to the once it gets to them. I don't think we'd lose any time. I think it's belt and suspenders. Are you okay with that?
Yes, thank you. That's okay. Fine with me, Mr. Chair. I also do sit on Ways and Means. So,
You get to shepherd it.
Full disclosure, I am expecting a technical amendment, which House Research is working with Representative Allen and myself on, and then I can probably bring that forward in Ways and Means before we move it to the General Register. So,
very
thank
good.
You so much.
Very good. And obviously, you'll keep in contact with your Senate partners on this too, so that we can get this important bill taken care of as well.
Yes, it anticipated to be heard in the Senate Commerce Committee next week, Mr. Chair.
All right. With that, I renew my motion that House File 4118 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. And with that, we're going to go to co-chair Cagle, and she's maybe going to be able to give us a little bit of a preview of what we're going to look at tomorrow. Co-chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So tomorrow we have two bills up, Rep. Moeller's bill on chemical irritants in homes and dealing with insurance, and then we have Representative Greenman's bill on corporate reset, and so that should be a lively discussion tomorrow. So we left plenty of time for it, so looking forward to it. Thank you.
Well, I hope we can sleep tonight.
Yeah.
With that, being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.